You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Today, my guest is Josh East. Though Josh has an extensive background in the music industry, he's also a collector of ancient relics and has acquired some very interesting and rare objects. One is called the Dropa Stones. We'll be talking about those. And he has several other interesting things that he will be talking about in relation to the spiritual aspect. So let's find out more about Josh now and about these antiques that come from ancient pasts. Hi, Josh. How are you?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Maybe you could give me, let's start out with a little background about, you know, your life and how you happen to, you know, come across these various objects and what they are.
Well, let's see here. As you mentioned, my background is heavily involved in the music industry. I started getting into more of the conscious realm probably during the music digital age, which was around 2000. Mm-hmm. And that's when the music industry in itself really was struggling with illegal downloads, and more like 2001, 2002 was where it really heightened. And my business really took a hit at that time, which we specifically concentrated on marketing and promotions from anyone from, from Eminem to Snoop Dogg to Maya to Kirk Franklin. It's all over the board, even into more eclectic music like Ozo Motley. And once the whole digital age shift occurred in the music industry, the budget was just pretty much undwindled. And we ended up taking a hit with regards to our services and our whole entire business model in general. And what happened from there was we ended up going into more of a strategic pattern, and wanted to concentrate more so on the independent artists and label community instead of the major labels.
Mm.
So what that ended up doing was it probably took about a good 2 years for us to get involved in that whole aspect of this new business model. But in that time frame, we ended up going into a lot of meetings that seemed as if it was just more so directing into the conscious realm of alternative knowledge. And that's kind of where we spun off and really wanted to concentrate more so on seeing how we could concentrate more on conscious music more than, non-conscious music with respects to having a more positive lyrical content, educating, you know, keywords and phrases within the lyrical songs themselves. And that really got us into research projects. And from there, I mean, personally, and I could speak from a handful of our team through the company Music One, we really started to experience some guidance within these topics. And it really concentrated trade anywhere from ancient, scientific to, you know, forbidden knowledge, as what we called it. And on a personal note, that's when I really started getting some contacts within the field of I guess what the mainstream is calling, you know, the new age community. And at the time, this was probably 2003, when I started connecting with a Mayan timekeeper in Los Angeles, and also a shaman from Ecuador, that were all out here in L.A., and we decided to get Red Elk out here in L.A. to speak on his experiences and his knowledge with respect to health and the Bible, and of course his one of his number one topics, which is more so the underworld, you know, entities or whatnot.
Wow.
And that was pretty exciting, and that whole thing really spiraled into getting into contacts within the Crystal Skull community. And that's where I got in contact with a now who's a good friend of mine in China. He does not want me to say his name, but he was the one who found the 13 crystal skulls in the Himalayan Valley Range.
Wow.
And this gentleman also found a few discs that were buried within the crystal skulls.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
So that's the short version of the background. So
yeah.
That really got me into, more interesting things of the ancient relics and whatnot. So essentially, all in all, my contact out in China did come on a tour out here in the U.S. with the skulls, and that's when he realized that the skulls needed to be distributed worldwide and used for the sole purpose of reconnecting certain energy grids around the world and being able to activate them on a world consciousness.
Wow. Now, you were introduced to the skulls. I mean, you were able to look at them and touch them and experience them for yourself?
Only a handful.
Only a handful.
At that time, there was distribution going on and whatnot.
Now, what did he say? Was he getting information directly from the skulls? Because many people claim that they speak telepathically to the person who owns the skull.
Yeah, I personally haven't had a relationship with one myself.
Okay.
But he himself, yeah, absolutely. He was definitely guided to locate the 13, and if you go onto the MySpace page, which is /Dropa, DROPA, DISKS, so that's MySpace.com/Dropa, DROPA, DISKS. This was just a page that we built to actually throw some of the relics up here, and one of them is a picture of the 13 crystal skulls that were found. And if you really look closely, each one was carved differently, and from the bone structure, I would say, in the jaw lines and the nose and the cheekbones and whatnot, and even the foreheads. I mean, there's elongated ones and there's fatter ones, and it seemed as if each one was from a different culture or a different species. It was pretty interesting. If we talk about the 12 tribes, I mean, that could almost be where some want to say that the 12 tribes are also connected to the universe. So it was an interesting find, and he did find a few discs. And I kind of want to correct you with respect to in the beginning of the show when you said something about the Dropa discs. I'm personally not too fond of the story that has been surfaced throughout the internet. There was a author by the name of Dr. Carl Robin Evans, and he is part of the storyline, right? The original story of the Dropa disc, which, mm-hmm. in short, for those who do not know about the story, I'm going to give you a real short version here.
As long as it takes. I mean, it's fascinating.
I'm thinking to get back on the right subject.
Right.
How the story goes was there was a professor who was on an archaeological dig, and I think from where the story goes, it was somewhere around the 1930s or somewhere around there, right?
Okay.
And this guy found. Claimed to find skeleton remains, right? And
right.
supposedly of apes. And basically, there was another professor who says that who ever heard of apes daring each other? And and so that started into this professor that actually quoted that. Going back to where the skeleton remains were found, and he actually ended up finding these large round stone discs, which looked like Stone Age, you know, gramophone records. And they had a hole in the center, and they had fine grooves, and some of them, I guess, were spiraling out from the center of the rim, right? And
well,
supposedly they were.
Yeah, I'm looking at your MySpace page now, and it's bringing up the various some examples of the discs and some ancient cave paintings, it looks like. So
yeah, there was a lot. You know, it's interesting that cave painting ended up being an actual artwork for a cover story of this exact story.
Huh.
And even though that there was like certain cave drawings in the Uzbekistan, you know, certain caves or whatnot, what ended up happening was this story, wherever it originated from, ended up circulating publications from 1960. And supposedly there was a Russian Digest article titled "Were Alien Visitors on Earth?"
Okay.
And this started circulating in 1960. Mm-hmm. I have not yet found any reference to this Russian Digest,
okay.
but in 1962, there was a German publication called and this is in English, obviously, but it was The Vegetarian Universe. And the title of that article was UFOs in Prehistory. And in 64 was another article in Germany. And then the Los Angeles Times actually had an article about it in 1967 called "Riddle of Asian Stone Disc from Outer Space."
Hmm.
And the most famous one was in 68, which was from the Sputnik magazine out in Russia.
Oh, yeah.
Titled "Stone Age Gramophone Records."
Oh, my
so
goodness. How appropriate
these,
for...
Exactly. It was just kind of like...
Yeah.
It, cool titles, right? And,
yeah.
And how appropriate. Exactly. To get back into the story,
yeah.
the What happened was, I mean, these supposedly the scientists studied and the this, and they were anywhere from 10 to 12,000 years old. Okay.
Wow.
And far, I guess, again, older by far than the greater pyramids of Egypt, supposedly. I disagree with that. I think the pyramids are much older than that. But But the interesting thing is that there is about 716. This is the exact number that was actually published as far as the discs that were found. 716. That's a lot.
Yeah,
and
a lot.
Especially for a cave, and it's just it doesn't make sense. But anyways, to get back on the subject, there was continuous lines of strange carved hieroglyphs, and almost microscopic, and they were never encountered before. So, in 62, so if we revert back to the articles, right, that we're generating.
Uh-huh.
The one that we do know of that was legit was the Vegetarian Universe out in Germany in 1962, right? Well, supposedly a Chinese professor by the name of Sun Um Ni in 1962 was able to decode the message of the stone plates. And and basically he was able to translate a message that says the Dropa came down from the clouds in their aircraft. Our men, women, and children hid in the caves 10 times before sunrise. And the story goes on and on about how they crashed. They were hunted by the Ham tribe, which I kind of correlated with the Ham tribe from the Bible. And they were hunting them down in that region because, I don't know, they thought that maybe they were threatening or whatnot, but they ended up being peaceful after a few years and, you know, interbreeding and whatnot. So it's interesting how this story kind of just evolved after 1962. During the publications and whatnot, you know, whether or not it's true or not, I mean, there's a lot of fabrications in the story. There is a ton of arguments, and basically, one of the main ones that I'm more in tune with is the fact that people claim these Dropa stones. But they're really known as bi discs, and bi is bi, and these were, you could find thousands of these discs across southern China, southeast China, and basically these discs could be anywhere from a few inches to a few feet. They're made of nephrite or jade, and they all have a small hole in the center, and they predate back to 300 BC. Now, the discs were, how they were used, they were usually buried beneath the feet of the deceased. But you had to be of a prominent person to actually receive this type of disc. And after the Shang Dynasty, the disc eventually took on some artwork, you know, so you could actually, you could go on eBay and search for buy discs. And you can actually see, you know, like maybe 1,000-year-old discs that 500-year-old discs that are around, and they have like artwork around, you know, dragons or you know, hieroglyphs that don't mean nothing, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's more artwork, but when I sat down with my Ecuadorian shaman friend. And he had some insight about the stones. I eventually did get 4 of them from my friend from China. And one of them is a 5-grooved stone, and it's if you lay your fingers in the grooves, Mm-hmm. And real smooth, like, because it's actually pretty silky. It looks as if it's like of a pearl essence.
Wow.
But you can tell there's crystal in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's really tough. It's a real hard stone. It's heavy. And if you put your fingers through the grooves, you could actually feel some texture to where it's almost like you could almost read something from it.
Wow. So in other words, there may be actual writing of some kind, some sort of communication in between the grooves.
Right. And that's something that kind of rings a bell with the story with respect to how microscopic these hieroglyphs supposedly were and blah, blah, blah. But to get back to the story again and not to go further with where it ended up,
okay.
This gentleman that I mentioned earlier, Dr. Carl Robin Evans, who might have not existed, by the way, he wrote a book called Sun Gods in Exile in 1978, and it was edited by a gentleman by the name of David Agamon, which was a Sueto. His real name was Gammon, and people think that David Agamon, who edited the book, was Dr. Carl Robin Evans, because Dr. Carl Robin Evans was the person who, in the story, in this book, was a British scientist, right? An English scientist who followed the trail of the Dropas to its origins and was able to take a rare photograph of the Dropa leaders in 1947.
Wow. And they were alive?
Yeah. And
wow.
There's actually pictures of them on the net, but, you know, essentially what happened was Agamon, okay, using his real name, Gammon, wrote to the British magazine 14 times, issue 75, stating that Sun Gods in Exile was his favorite hoax, and adding that the author of the leg, and I'm actually reading some information here right now, the author, and quote-unquote, the author of this leg toll received correspondence from as far away as Kiev. Don't ask me how I know. And basically, when Bob Rickard telephoned Gammon, and I guess I believe maybe Bob was part of 14 times, Gammon responded basically that he confessed to the deceit. And this whole story from this actual book kind of was almost generated out of the original story, and it kind of just brought more nonsense to the storyboard.
Okay.
So just from my research alone, I haven't done too much because I kind of stay away from it. I'm not interested in the story. I'm not interested in the original story because there's just too many flaws, and I just don't want to spend too much time and energy on it. But
right, but the stones are very real.
The stones are very real.
Yeah,
the five grooved one is unique. Obviously, there's another one that has it's a heavier one, and it's almost like a made out of like metal in the sense that like when you're lifting weights or whatnot, whatever the weights are actually made out of, it feels like this particular stone is made of that. It's so heavy, but in the center it's like an interlocking hole that if you actually fit it in a rod and you like twist it counterclockwise or something like that, it would actually lock.
Oh.
And it's interesting because it might have been a locking device or not, but it's something that I don't think was really used as a stone, back where I eventually found out that high priests that used these bidiffs, they would put it up into the sun, and they would actually have the sunlight go through the hole, and they would receive, you know, energy or messages, you know, through that. And so they would actually use the jade or whatever type of stone that was made of the bidisc, and kind of use that as a transmitter and a receiver, you know, for messages or whatnot. Well, I mean, this was 3000 BC. I mean, if those who know about ancient civilizations that were, you know, beyond that date. I mean, that's the only, we only know of the records from as far back as the Sumerian, you know, timeline. So,
right.
So it's kind of like, okay, well, before that, you know, obviously there was a lot of things going on or whatnot, but, what if these discs were bypassed from somewhere else and these high priests took it on as you know, something from the gods, and they would actually use it to communicate and receive information that way. You know what I'm saying? And so that's kind of like where my thoughts are at, because if it's something to where these ancient civilizations from Atlantis to Lemuria that did exist,
right,
then that predates way back, you know, maybe 10,000 years ago.
Yeah. Well, that almost puts us at a period when the last 13,000-year cycle came to a close.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, you know, that would have been about the ending, or, you know, around close to the ending of one of those civilizations. I don't remember the exact order, but I think Atlantis went first, and I think Lemuria was next. I'm not sure about the order of that, but anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked.
I think it was the other way around.
Okay, yeah. All right. Now, there's some anomalies about these, the people that were in the cave. They found bones and skulls there, you know, of the bodies. Isn't that correct? And they were very short, like 4'4", and they had large heads, and weren't there some strange aspects to their physiology?
Yeah, from how the story goes, they were anywhere from 3.5 feet tall to 4, you know, and they did have like larger skulls or whatnot. But you know, that even goes back to articles that were surfaced recently. I mean, we're talking like mid-90s, late-90s, when, I know in 97, in the USA Today, they published an article called Chinese Dwarfs. And basically, from what I recall, the article mentioned that there was indigenous lands that really suffer from poor water, because that's where they, you know, where there's really no commerce going on or whatnot, you know, that's where they dump these metals and, you know, things that you know, if someone did drink from those waters, I mean, obviously it was gonna turn your body chemistry into something else. So
well, isn't that kind of happening today anyway?
It is. And
unfortunately.
And I guess there were some metals that I think mercury is one of them that I'm not too sure about that, but I guess when a woman is pregnant or whatnot, they say not to eat too much fish because of the mercury and whatnot, because it kind of will it may have defects on the baby or whatnot, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So
and
it's kind of like. I'm sorry?
Oh, and then the whole idea that vaccinations have mercury, and, you know,
that
mercury
too.
Is used widely, even though, you know, in dentistry they know how dangerous it is because it causes brain damage. And it actually kind of, I've done a little bit of research on this, and they claim that you know, the brain is simply not as alert and functioning as clearly. So, and there's a lot of mercury in many products that we ingest, so, including vaccinations. For some reason, it's in vaccinations. So, I'm just making a comment about that.
And that brings back the, with the Chinese dwarf article, if there was dumping of these metals and whatnot, it's possible that the dwarfism that was going on in these parts of China, you know, was caused by that. So you know, when you hear about these skeletons and whatnot, you know, this is where my skeptic mode comes in, obviously, and it's like, well, you know, maybe there was some sort of you know, dumping going on back then, you know, for
no, probably, you know, yeah. Although my inclination would be, just given the amount of research I've done on, you know, various ET cultures and the fact that they've been here for, you know, since the beginning of time practically,
yeah.
And they come in all different shapes and sizes, it seems possible that, you know, the story would support these were
advanced.
You
can't throw it out, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You can't throw that out, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
It's interesting though, like how these stories surface, you know, right after information like this does come out, and people try to connect the dots in ways that, you know, there's really no proof behind it. But you know, you do have to throw the argument out there and see where it goes and whatnot. But it's interesting because the whole story. I mean, there's some. The entire story, the Dropa story, I mean, there's a lot of these arguments that for example, there was a professor from a school that was called the Peking Academy of prehistory, and it never existed. That was kind of thrown in there. There was that Su Mumni, professor that I told you about, is actually a Japanese name adapted to Chinese. So there's like no reports of him that ever existed.
Let me ask you a quick question. Did your Mayan shaman friend have a chance to examine the stones, and did, if so, did he pick up any vibrations or communications from them?
Oh yeah. We've done quite a bit of experiments on the disc, and there's two of them actually. Besides the five grooved width, there's an aquatic looking one. It does look like it's got quite a bit of jade elements to it, but in the center. In the center of the circle, there's a rim that goes around, and it's if you predate it, you know, maybe 1,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago or whatever, you can tell back then it was pretty sharp. But you know, throughout the years, you know, obviously it kind of got dull. But he did mention from those two discs that they carry a lot of information, and that the entities that use the five groove discs, their hands aren't they don't, you know, we're if you look at our palm and then all of a sudden we got fingers coming out, you know, these entities were more like webbed in the sense that they were shorter, you know, stubbier, you know, fingers, if you want to call that, to where they would be able to, if the discs were spun, and this kind of goes into research from my Chinese friend, where he who discovered, you know, some of the discs and the skulls together, where he felt that the skulls were the were the generator, the computer generator, and the disks were the hard drives.
Oh.
And so in order to conduct them in the way of receiving the information, the disk had to obviously sit on a table. Well, my shaman friend did say that they did use a table, but it was a magnetic table. And the whole
wow.
table was made out of a huge magnet. So when you put the disc on the table, and you spun it, but how did it spin? You know, so he was receiving information to where, like, well, there's certain minerals that if you actually want to conduct the spinning, then you've got to have some sort of harmonics
in order
to resonate and basically raise. So how from what I remember was that this table was like an octagon, and each point had a different mineral, and each point it could have been a quicksilver, a certain metal or whatnot, but he said that each 5 points would be able to spin the disc at a certain speed.
Wow.
And then there was this coil that came out to where it was made out of gold, and it was a spiral coil. And when the disc started spinning, it would actually heat the spiral, and you know when it heats it, you know the gold expands, right?
Right.
So
right.
So when it expands, that's when the coil would actually be the device that would actually hum and whatnot. And when the disc spun, that's when the entities would actually fit their hands on and receive the information from the disc at that point.
Well, that is really fascinating because, you know, if they were indeed, I mean, if there's any truth at all to the part that they were, you know, that they were stranded here from another civilization, then it seems likely that they would want to use their technology, which would be entirely different from anything that we would, you know, comprehend, to communicate with their people. I, you know, it just would make sense.
Yeah, he told me that the entities that used the stones were actually Martian.
Really?
And
wow.
They the reason for them coming down was because they're at the time, you know, that planet was suffering, and they needed to find another spot that had the right minerals, because I guess they only ate minerals.
Interesting.
And I guess Earth had the proper minerals for them to survive or whatnot. And so the scientists were the ones that came out in their ships and tried to locate and find the best places. And obviously a couple of them crashed, and that's kind of like when the whole thing happened where, you know, they had their technology with them and kind of left it here and maybe
and
started
kept it private
it.
In the caves, right? Because they were kind of hiding out in the caves, and then all of those stones were in the caves, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, what's really fascinating is that I just watched an interview, a Project Camelot interview. I think it was with Bob Dean, and he shows pictures of the infrared surface of Mars, and there's quite clearly a base there underneath the ground. And one of my guests, Andrew D. Bajago, was part of a Vatican/DARPA/CIA program called Project Pegasus, and they were involved in the early days in the 60s and 70s with time travel. And towards the end of his involvement with that project, he actually visited that underground base with his handler. And he claims to have been there twice. And he said, you arrive at the underground base, but you can walk out of these carved heads that have eyes. They look like skulls. And they walked for some distance on the surface somehow. I don't know if they used masks or what. But he went into quite a bit of detail about it and about the other people that were there. He said there were other kids from the project, you know, that were there. And there were other ET races as well. And on the surface of Mars were strange animals. And one of the stories that I do remember, he said, was that he asked his handler if these things were dangerous. And he said, as in, do they eat meat? And he said, yes. In fact, we're going to be walking back to the base, and when I tell you to, run. And so that's what happened. They kind of turned around, and then they ran back to the base because apparently this strange-looking animal was quite dangerous to humans. So, but that was the story. So it's starting to come out, the information's starting to come out through many different sources, that there really is and was a civilization on Mars and still is to this day.
Well, you know, that's interesting because it's just kind of all surfacing and whatnot. And it's when my shaman friend continued on the explorations of the disk, he knew that the Hopi civilization also knew about them.
Wow.
About the disc and about the tables and the Yaqui tribe. He actually retrieved the story about when the conquistadors came.
Oh,
the Yaqui. The Yaqui tribe, who was more like up in Baja California, like maybe like in between Baja California and Rosarito.
Uh-huh.
Up in that whole territory, which is pretty vast.
Uh-huh.
They were much taller than a lot of the other tribes at the time. And he basically said that once they knew that they landed, the Yaquis were like supposedly the fastest messengers for any emergency. So they started booking up towards the mesas. and that's when he also received that they took some relics, and one of them was a table with a few discs or whatnot. And
wow,
they started booking in a whole different other direction.
Huh.
And that's when he actually started crying when he started talking about this, because they were at the time it was. The weather was bad. It was raining and whatnot. And a couple of them caught a cold or something like that. So they ended up just kind of like burying themselves with the relics because they knew that they weren't going to make it.
Wow, my goodness. So it sounds like there's a connection between the Hopi and the Mayan and some of these other civilizations that
absolutely.
Is connected by.
Absolutely, you got Humbats Man that was, you know, that talks about the Mayan priests at one point were guided to go to the east to establish the most sacred land of the world, and they actually ended up in the Himalayas and met with some other priests that were of, you know, before it was called the Thet, up in those areas, and they ended up staying there for a handful of years and trying to understand each other's language, and they ended up being guided to meet each other because they were on the same mission to actually form the most sacred land, and that's when Tibet was actually formed.
Oh.
So they talk about that travel. And so there is a huge connection with that. Obviously, the Mayans do connect with the Hopi. I mean, they got the whole the sacred herb that they use for ceremonial use, copal. It's C-O-P-A-L, or it could be spelled with the K. If in between, it's actually in San Diego County before it actually hits Arizona. Mm. There's a border, and it's obviously east of Palm Springs, but it's southeast, obviously, of Palm Springs. But there is a desert out there that has all these copal trees. That are growing in these interesting like rock formation region, and they just grow like out of the rocks and out of the sand and whatnot. But it's very rocky terrain, and each tree is marked by the government. Each tree has its own number.
Interesting.
And they've got helicopters flying over that region like crazy.
What do you think that means?
Well, I was actually with the Mayan timekeeper on this trip, and he was basically. And I actually brought this question up because I was feeling that there was some sort of tunnel system underneath, and this was kind of like a tracking, I guess, by growing the copal just in this region was kind of the identification of, you know, letting whoever knew about this that, okay, this is where the cave. This is where the tunnel systems end or start.
Ah,
you know?
Kind of like an ancient living map.
Pretty much.
Wow.
In the sense of that, and so yeah, it was a fun experience, that's for sure.
Well, now what is the connection, if there is one, between the Dropa stones and the crystal skulls?
I know crystals are definitely something that could be used to extract information from the disc if that is the case. You know, if you could extract information from these discs, then crystal would obviously be one way to probably extract it out of. So I'm assuming, and this is coming from the education that my contact over in China was telling me about, you know, the discovery and whatnot, that they play a major role in it. It depends on whether or not they were maybe created for that or for other purposes.
Wow.
So it's, he was even bringing up the fact of, the levitation, the gravity level of how they're used is something that the crystal skulls play a huge part of as well. So
it's fascinating. You know, I wish we understood more about the connection between things, but it seems that. It's very difficult to really delve into it and get down to the nitty gritty.
You gotta find the right.
Yeah.
I mean, if that is the case, you have to find the right disc that was purposely created for that.
Right.
Because, again, you know, ancient China has thousands and thousands and thousands of these discs.
Wow, fascinating. That's just amazing. And obviously they probably have some kind of spiritual significance as well, because they're devices or objects that contain information and can communicate.
Yeah, you definitely have to have, I mean, you would want to definitely have that caretaker title to it, because essentially the connection, the spiritual connection of these are pretty pretty amazing. I mean, the one, the interlocking one, it's got dark energy, and it's actually kept in a box.
Ooh.
In its own, like, box where it's, like, fitted perfectly and,
wow.
and whatnot. So, you know, we don't,
you don't
mess
play
around
one.
With that. No, but the others are very, very positive. Yeah.
I want to, we're going to be out of time very shortly, but before we wrap anything up, because I'd like to do a part two with you, because this is such an interesting subject, and we could just call this one part one. But on the phone the other day, you mentioned that we are in the quickening, which I agree with, and I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about what you feel that is, or it signifies for humanity at this time.
Well, that's such a broad subject anymore, isn't it? I think, you know, when I did mention the quickening, time itself is just, it's really almost non-existing. Even the memories of you know, day-to-day activity is being lost so quickly.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, maybe it's some mercury that we can't retain it, right? But it's something that is happening at a time frame that's necessary for any shift. I mean, whether or not it's a conscious shift or whether or not it's a solar activity type shift, especially being in cycle 24 right now and whatnot. But
all right, right.
It's something that obviously we're in. We're in a transition that our ancients have warned us about, and whether or not it's a catastrophe or whether or not it's something that is a universal shift with the planets, and obviously that's going to add some sort of chemistry twist to our human, you know, genome.
Mm-hmm.
Then I mean, there's obviously a lot of evidence going on with you know, our cells being made of light and you know, kind of connecting with a lot of research with the crystal, quote unquote, crystal children, that their DNA strands are a little bit, you know, different from where it was, like, you know, 100 years ago or whatnot. A lot of that private research that kind of was surfacing for a while now, but now it's kind of like dwindled off, which is interesting.
There's a lot going on with magnetism too, and you know, talk about the pole shift and so on and so forth. And
there's a lot.
Know,
a good friend of mine was telling me the other day, you know what? Every single prophecy that the Hopis have brought out are, you know, they've already been revealed. You know, it's already happened. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's one last one, and I haven't done too much research on the Hopi prophecies, but there's one last one, and it has something to do with dropping the bombs. They're all waiting for the bombs to drop. And I was like, really? I was like, okay.
Well, you know,
there's that.
Yeah, it is conceivable.
Yeah.
But you're right, all of the crisscross spider webs in the skies, and that could be easily be telephone poles, or it could be chemtrails. But we have about a minute or two left. Is there anything you'd like to share with the audience, or any sites that you would like the listeners to visit to, you know, that would be of interest?
Well,
other than,
you know,
your MySpace.com DropaDisc site is really interesting.
That could actually be probably the best thing. That kind of gives you the idea of the whole storyboard. It gives you the pictures of the relics that we're taking care of and doing research on. If there's any interest of the subject matter or whatnot, they could feel free to email me at humanityunite@yahoo.com.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And that one right there is mainly just to let everyone know that, again, you know, I'm really not too interested in the research of where the story is at, but mainly what if these bi discs previously titled bi discs have been used for any type of electromagnetic uses or whatnot. You know, that's kind of where we're at. Studying the discs.
It'll be interesting to see, because I'm sure that there will be some listeners that hear the show tonight or in the future, because the show will be archived, that know something about these discs and the skulls. So I just want to thank you for bringing such a wealth of information to light, and for being on the show, and for doing a part one of a two-part show with me.
Sure, Lance.
And I can't wait to have you back in a couple months, and we'll finish up and explore some of these ancient mysteries even more.
Yeah, I look forward to it too, brother.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Josh. I'm very grateful for you being on the show.
All right, we'll be talking soon.
All righty. And good night, everybody, and stay tuned for Jim Gilliland. Good night.